listener production.
Okay, are you recording?
G'day and welcome along to Series 6 of the Howie Games, Episode 71, Part A. If you're listening to Part B and you haven't heard Part A, I'd go back to Part A first. Alrighty, hope you're all fit, firing, smiling and looking forward to the new series. We have got some cracking guests coming your way and cannot wait for you to hear them. But firstly, we have been loving all the feedback on social media at MarkHoward03 as well as at thehowiegames@hotmail.com. Stories about what the show means to you, lessons you've taken from it, places you have listened, which are my favourite, on tractors, down mines, piloting boats, driving trucks, on the way to sport with kids, in the gym, on overseas adventures. I love hearing about it, so please keep sending them through. Plus, the reviews and ratings on iTunes have been really, really cool and it helps the show spread. So if you could hit that up when you've got a moment, that'd be epic. And if you haven't already, grab someone you love, give them a hug and tell them about the Howie Games. Get them on board. Thank you.
Mystery, what is to be? So much more than meets the eye. Listen to me, time is your key. You will find out by and by.
As per Series 5, the episodes in this series will drop every second Thursday. So Episode 72, Part A and B, will be out on Thursday, July 18. But if you hit subscribe on your device, you will not miss any of the episodes. And don't worry, subscribing doesn't cost a cent. Still free, you'll get every episode.
You can do it if you try, try, try. If you try, try, try.
Alrighty, episode 71, and it is a two-for-one deal. The idea of the Howie Games right from the start has been to try and take you into the lives of athletes to tell their stories in an open, honest, raw at times and very warm manner, and hope that these stories will motivate and inspire you. For mine, this episode, featuring Kate and Bronte Campbell, is the perfect representation of the aims of this show. The Campbell sisters. The Campbell sisters are two of the most delightful people one could ever meet. They are smiley, happy, bubbly, loud, and funny, but they also have an iron will that has helped the girls become world champions in the pool. There's not much this episode doesn't have: swimming with hippos, a fantail quiz competition, which we've never done before, hard-earned successes, and during the second half of the episode, the brutal nature of professional sport, injury, pain, defeat, and lots of tears as the sisters talk about what happens when a dream shattered. If my children were to grow up and have the grace, the intelligence, the honesty, and the warmth of Kate and Bronte Campbell, I reckon I'd be pretty happy. And there's not much more a father can say than that. Enjoy Kate and Bronte Campbell.
So when you search and then you find and know just where to go and thoughts that once used to cloud your mind, you see clearly and now you know. Mystery, what is to be revealed in King Selassie I. Come on children, trot with me, we wanna reach Mount Zion I.
Welcome to the Howie Games, a double act, Kate and Bronte Campbell. How are you both?
Very well, thank
Very
you.
Very good, thanks.
It's great to see the both of you because normally in this situation you're both puffing. I'm at the side of the pool. There's goggles being flung up everywhere. There's hair being done and we're talking about exceptional performances. So
fortunately, no boogers. Like
no.
Poor old Ian Thorpe. Oh. Fortunately not.
We did address that in the last episode with Thorpe. Yep. I don't know if you listened to it. No, you two are always magnificently presented. Hey, before we get into this, we're at a nice spot in Coogee. Bront, you have found your way in the business centre where we are to the fantails. What have you got for us?
I think it was the first thing I noticed when I opened, entered the room. All right, well, hands on your buzzers.
Okay.
Who am I?
All right.
Born in Scotland in 1956, he moved to Australia in 1961. An apprentice iron smelter whose love for music led him to join a...
Oh, gosh, I can't get on the fry. I'm going... Jubar.
Yeah.
Oh, no, you can't answer second. I've taken down the world record.
Okay, it's not quick on the buzzer.
And that is an achievement for me today. How are you both? Well, I arrived in Sydney yesterday. This won't go to air for a while, but splashed across the front page of the paper, you two. Very good. Talking about this new swimming competition. What's it all about, Bron?
ISL. ISL is, it's interesting. It's, for us, it just represents a really good opportunity to diversify swimming and make it more interesting, more relevant, and get more competition happening. So basically, as a rundown, FINA is sort of like our governing body, and they run all the international competitions. Then ISL is being set up, and It's this amazing guy who's got a big love of swimming and lots of cash behind him, and he wants to set up a swimming league where you compete in swim teams. So you draft it onto a team and you'll compete against each other, and there'll be, I think, 6 competitions to start with, and they'll be across Europe and America. And short events, so I think it's 200 and under, maybe one 400-meter event, and just competing against each other and making it like a big, fun exhibition. Sort of like, you talk about Big Bash for cricket, that sort of idea. So for us, it's super exciting because it means we get to race internationally more. It means swimming becomes more fun and more relevant. And all I want is for it to be a bigger thing, because we only ever really see swimming once every 4 years or once a year if people are really paying attention.
Absolutely. So it's cool. The headline out of it was originally, if you swim in this, you're not going to be going to the Olympics, which was the headline, which is the way the media operates.
Well, that was true, though.
It was true. So
how did all that play out, and how was it for you two going through that?
Yeah, well, so there was supposed to be kind of an exhibition meet scheduled for December of last year, and FINA, our world governing body, kind of got a wind of this and thought that the ISL was going to be trampling on their turf a little bit and said if swimmers take part in this, because it's not a FINA-sanctioned meet, they risk a ban from either the World Championships this year or the Olympics in 2020.
Wow, that's a big stick.
Which is a big stick. What I really like about the ISL is that they do put athletes first. So in good faith, they cancelled the swimming competition, but they still held a meeting over in London, and kind of all the swimmers got in the room and we kind of said, hang on, this is ridiculous. You're taking away opportunities for us to compete, to raise revenue for ourselves and to grow the sport of swimming. And we kind of said that we'd band together, and if you banned one of us, then we would all boycott. And, you know, there's some really global superstars who were in that room, you know,
including the Campbell sisters.
And I think that FINA were just kind of like, oh, can you imagine if there was a world championship with, you know, at the likes of Adam Peaty, who's the British, you know, superstar, or Sarah Sorstrom from Sweden, you know, it just wouldn't be a world championships. So they've removed the threat of the ban, which is really exciting. And while all times that are swum at the ISL competition will be unofficial, so if a world record is broken, it won't count.
I see.
We're now free to compete, which is really exciting.
The other part you mentioned too was raising revenue. I think you mentioned, Bront, every 4 years we see you guys, we see the top echelon on the cereal packets, on the ads, and we think, wow, these guys are making a lot of money, like our cricketers or our tennis players or our footballers. Not the case, especially when you scratch a tiny bit below the surface. Unless you're basically the best in the world, it's not an easy way to make a living. So does this assist in that?
Yeah, this is something that's going to be able to keep people in the sport, let people make a living. Lots of swimmers have day jobs as well. They're working part-time and swimming full-time and often trying to study as well. So it's not an easy ask to be a swimmer. It's not, like you say, every 4 years you see the top people advertising for things, but there's 40 people on the team, and there's 40 people that deserve recognition or at least to be able to support themselves through to the next 4 years. So it's definitely going to do that. And for us, like coming into the back end of your sport, we've been around for a while. It's a motivation to keep going, because as you get older and older, you're like, well, then that's when your peers start sort of having their big careers and you're still doing the same sort of thing and sort of feel like you're falling behind. So it's a good opportunity to set yourself up as towards the end of your career as well. But it's just a good opportunity for everyone.
It's one of life's cruel ironies that the older you get, the less fun training gets.
Yes.
I remember being super excited as a kid to go to training, and in school holidays I could train 6 days a week instead of 5, and that was like a big thing. Now I'm like, oh my gosh, please give me Saturday mornings off. So it keeps it interesting. We get to race and break up the training, because let's face it, staring at a black line for 4 hours a day is not the most mentally stimulating thing you can do with your life.
What do you think about? Do you switch off, or do you have to? Because that's the question for everyone that doesn't swim: is how on God's name do you turn up at 4:30 in the morning and look at that line for 3 hours, go to the gym, and come back and do it again at night time?
All right. So when you're by yourself, it's really not that fun.
So boring.
I've done a lot of training by myself in the past year, and you need a squad. You don't even have to talk to them that much. It just needs to be other people there, or you do go a little bit nuts. But we are thinking about what we're doing most of the time. sometimes more than others.
It is interesting, though, like once you hit the end of the pool in the middle of a set and some of the thoughts that come out, like people just say something and you're like, what were you thinking about during that 400 yeah, okay. meters? You've gone a long way from our last conversation. But yeah, most of the time we are concentrating.
But it's if you go for a run and you run in a different spot, like here for me, for Coogee, it's stimulating because it's something different. So you don't think about the fact that you're knackered. Whereas if you're running the same track the whole time, you start to think you're tired, which I presume is the same when you're looking at that line and you start
thinking, well, that's why we had to move to Sydney.
Right. But how different is a black line, whether it's in Queensland or in Sydney?
Oh, this one's quite a good one. It's kind of like a dark blue line. It's got a diving end of the pool, so it gets deeper at one point.
You know. It's got red tiles that mark the 15 metres.
Whoa! Yeah. You guys are really going out there, aren't
you? It's getting wild out of Dimble, that's for sure.
You both walked in here and I was excited to see you, and then you flapped me a bit by saying, wow, did we get a question from the pig on the big penguin? There was no questions as to what I asked you. So you obviously listen to podcasts, and I'm stoked that you listen to this one, but you listen to podcasts? You joining the podcast revolution?
Oh, I love podcasts.
I'm much like pioneering the podcast revolution.
Right, yeah. Fantastic. Yeah.
Everything under the sun I listen to. So if anyone has any recommendations, please let me know in some way, because I'm always on the hunt for a new one. And now that we're in Sydney, I've just decided I'm going to embrace the traffic life.
Yes.
And just relax with a podcast.
Yes.
And
yes.
Then there's no need for road rage. And by the time I get to the place, I've learned something, or I've laughed, or I've cried, and, you know...
So when are the Campbell sisters starting their own? Because I think people will be evidenced by the first 8.5 minutes of this. I think it'll be an entertaining show.
We've thought about it, actually. We were just chatting about it the other day. We were thinking, like, maybe we could sit down once a week and just talk about the sports stories and give, yes, like, a sports person's perspective on it, which is good, but it's also good to show that we've got quite different opinions sometimes. So it'd be a good chat. Anyway, that was... That was our idea about a week ago, so we'll see whether that gets
up and
rolling.
When running, I will promote it on the Howie Games Great Vigour and Pride. All right, let's go back to the start where this all started, because it's not a typical grew up in Queensland, started swimming story for you two. It's a very different story, well publicised, but those that don't follow the sport closely wouldn't know it. So firstly, where were you both born?
We're born in Malawi.
It's a little African country.
I've been there.
You've been there?
I have been there.
No one's
Why?
Been there.
I've been there. Travelling through Africa, learnt to scuba dive it in Carter Bay.
Ooh, great place, yeah.
Got malaria in Carter Bay.
I got malaria there too.
Congratulations.
Malaria, buddy.
It was 97. I remember the roads being the worst of I'd seen in Africa,
bad,
but the people the friendliest. Outstanding place.
97, we would have still been there then.
Yeah, I'd have seen you as little tackers swimming around.
Probably.
So how did you come to be born in a small African nation bordered by a lake called Malawi?
Mum and Dad were South African, and they moved to Malawi for work for, you know, a one-year contract, and 10 years later they had 4 kids there. So
what was the contract? What was your dad or mum doing?
It was Dad who was moving for a banking job.
He's an accountant.
Finance related.
As their eyes glaze over.
They're very handy people to have in the family.
Hello to your dad, who's a proud accountant, while you roll your eyes.
My dad's amazing. And he does my taxes.
Fantastic.
Long-suffering dad. And yeah, so we were born there.
Which is tremendously adventurous and exciting.
It was a great place to be a kid. Yeah. I almost, you know, want to have kids there just because, well, the freedom that you get. And also you don't notice the inconveniences. Like, you know, mum would go to the supermarket and the only flour that was on offer was full of weevils. So unbeknownst to us, we just ate weevily cake.
Because that's what it was.
Yeah. Or, you know, the only milk that would be there would be sour. So she'd just have to make something with sour milk. So yeah, as a kid, you don't notice those inconveniences, and there's just freedom galore. And we had a wonderful time growing up on the lake. It's where we spent almost every weekend. Our dad used to sail catamarans. So we used to go out and mum would you know, drive the trailer around from place to place while Dad would sail along the lake. And
catamarans like darts and nakras, not like,
more like a ship.
No. Like trampolines, little twin-hull racing, sailing sort of stuff.
How did the catamaran go on the roads of Malawi that I did mention, where the bus driver who'd done the route 1,000 times, he'd say, oh, how long is this going to take, boss? He'd say, an hour and a half, 7 hours later.
Yeah.
You think, he did this trip yesterday. He knows it takes 7 hours, but he's not telling me that.
They're very optimistic people.
Yes, which is one of the great things about the country.
So it could take an hour. Right. It could take an hour if it was, you know, a tarred road, but it's not, so.
We've been back there once in 2010.
And struck you?
Well, there was big signs everywhere saying tarred roads, an innovation in Malawi.
So they're getting better.
And there was the one traffic light in Blantyre was working while we were there, which I don't think I'd ever seen it working when we lived there. So in 10 years, they now have some tarred roads, and the one traffic light is what was working for the 4 days that we were there.
My memory of it, I don't think it was Blantyre. It could have been the Longwy. And this would be, you two are too young for this, but there was a Carlsberg brewery. And you could do tours.
Okay, we
and
didn't
when
do that.
You'd been 9 months in Africa and had no money, mm-hmm. when someone's advertising a free brewery tour, next time you go back, okay. check if it's still going.
All right. Well, this is probably a bit controversial, but we never did brewery tours, but our dad's company used to sell tobacco. So we used to go to like the tobacco, like drying things, they'd dry all the tobacco leaves. Like, obviously never been a smoker, but the smell of like tobacco leaves getting dried is just so amazing. You'd walk through the warehouses and there's just stacks of these dried up leaves. Probably not a great industry, but when I was seven, it seemed magical.
You two were asking about the pickle and the penguin. So right near the start, you are going to face the big penguin, who is lucky enough, the day after the Big Bash finishes, so probably after this has gone to air, he is making his first trip to Africa, which he is very, very, very excited about. All sorts of rumours and innuendo and stories about you two and growing up. I'm not sure what is true, what is not true. The penguin wanted to get right to the bottom of it. He's starting with you, Kate.
All right.
Hi, Kate. Big Penguin here. I've been reading Wikipedia about you, and it said that you swam near a hippopotamus in Africa when you were young. Firstly, I want to know, is this true or false? And also,
Now I've got a phone call coming through in the middle of that. Hang on, here we go.
Going to Africa soon. Should I swim near hippopotamuses?
Wow!
He was battling his way through Wikipedia. He raced out and said, Dad, I know why she swims so fast. She used to swim with hippos.
Well, actually, that is true.
Well done.
Yeah. Wikipedia got one right. There was the right where we used to stay on the lake. There was kind of this rogue hippopotamus that used to come and used to eat the lawns at night, because they're funny things because they look terrifying, but they eat grass, but then they're also very vicious and they just like to kill you for fun. That's the downside of hippos.
Wait, you know they can run 40 k's an hour?
Yeah.
Like they look ridiculous. They don't look like they should be able to do anything other than roll over or something, but they're incredible.
Move. Yeah, and normally it would like go away during the day and just come back at night. But we were out in a little tinny one day and I jumped off the side and was swimming around. And then next second you just hear this like, whoosh. And it was a hippo just on the other side of the boat. I got back in that boat very, very, very quickly. The hippo was after that, ate, well, just kind of chomped a few of the villagers.
So
got relocated to hippo heaven.
Right, yeah. So the second part of the question, should the big penguin jump in somewhere upstream of Victoria Falls where he's going and swim?
Well, if he can run over 40 k's an hour, then
probably,
go for it.
Probably not.
Otherwise, yeah, maybe steer clear.
The other thing that they were both fascinated by, this is not about me and my travels, this show, this is about you two, but last year after the Big Bash, we went to Costa Rica and Panama, which is fantastic, and we were staying at a small place where the kids were homeschooled. And my wife and I looked at it and looked at the way these young men were and their view on the world and were blown away. You two were homeschooled?
Yeah, in Africa we were homeschooled. We didn't go to school until we came to Australia in 2001.
So do you remember much about that, Bront, or not? You would have been a very, very
young
girl.
I was young, but I mean, I was seven, but you remember a lot from it.
So by your parents?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, by our parents. But there was a big community of expat children, so we'd all sort of we had like a homeschool curriculum that got sent from America. So it was an American one. So I actually did tons of American history, which was pretty hilarious. But we did that by ourselves, and then we'd all come together with all the other expat kids and do like choir practice or swimming practice or something.
Put on a play.
Yeah, the choir thing wasn't really my forte.
Really?
Really?
any sort of choral work that you want to reflect on and give us a go on the Howie Games or not?
No, I don't think anyone needs to hear that.
It'd be a nice combination, you two together.
I'm pretty sure the microphone would break. That's one of the good things, actually. You know, when we're on the podium and you're singing the national anthem and some. I think Kate got a tweet once being like, oh, you look like you're a really good singer. I was like, how can someone look like they're a good singer? It's just good that there's no microphones there because we are awful, but we always super loud, so it's a bit of fun, but I'm glad there's no mics
around there. Yeah, we learned to project, just not in tune.
Right. What are your memories of being schooled in that way as a youngster?
Yeah, Mum, we used to... It was amazing how much work you could get done when it's just kind of one-on-one, or Mum used to, one-on-three, because Mum used to teach me and Bronte and then one of our younger sisters as well. And we'd have to do lessons in the morning and then we could play in the afternoon. And I can remember just having meltdowns over maths and like I wasn't allowed to leave my desk until I'd figured out the maths equations, and there were so many tears, and little smarty pants Bronte would finish her work and be out playing, and then like she'd come and stick her head around and be like, are you done yet, Kate? I was like, no, I'm trying to do long division.
It was good though when you came to Australia, and then we obviously went to school for the first time. We were quite far ahead of where everyone else was, just because the things that you're good at, you get, and then you move on quickly and you can go to the next phase because it's just you. And then the things that you don't get, you can spend all the time working on them. So it was definitely good when we were young. But
Little grammar Nazi Bronte corrected her grade 3 teacher. About adverbs.
You shouldn't like that.
You know what I'm stoked about is, Kate, that you and I, in a weird way, have both sat next to Lake Malawi, me doing a diving course, trying to figure out the dive tables, thinking I can't do this maths, and you're obviously the same.
Oh, just horrifically bad. Yeah, it's just not something my brain does. No. I try really hard, but it just doesn't stick.
We won't talk to smarty pants over there.
Yeah, no, smarty pants numbers girls over here.
I'm not actually that good at maths.
In comparison, it's just a lot better though. Although my bar is pretty low.
Why the move to Australia? It's funny, you talk to people. It's a massive move. I'm a parent now, so I've got kids your age. So imagine if I said to my kids tomorrow, right, we're moving to Malawi. We did think about Costa Rica, but that's sort of slightly different. But it's a massive move for your parents, isn't it?
It's huge. Our mum and dad came over. They had 4 kids under 9, 7, 5, and 3.
Wow.
And mum was 7 months pregnant with the 5th. And they came over, dad didn't have a job, and they knew one other person. And
they had one phone number of a friend of a friend. No job, no car, no place to live.
So why were they doing it?
So our brother, who is the 4th one?
Yeah.
Yes, Hamish, has cerebral palsy. And he has cerebral palsy because of a very traumatic birth. So he was a stillborn. And there's just no medical services in Malawi that can cater for that. So kind of he was airlifted to South Africa sort of within hours of his birth. And mum had had a few complications later on in the pregnancy, which in retrospect needed to be fixed up. And so when Abigail, the surprise, came along, I think they'd talked about moving to Australia for a while, but I think that when mum fell pregnant with Abigail, they just thought it's not safe to have another child here. So hightailed it to Australia. So Abigail, the youngest, was actually born in Australia.
So you went to Brizzy?
Yes.
Yeah, we went via Melbourne.
Do you remember?
Was it
an exciting trip? Was it a scary trip? Were you speaking Afrikaans at home?
No, we weren't. We always spoke English. Right. And actually in Malawi, Chichewa is the local language.
Right.
So
what was the local language?
Chichewa.
Do you remember any?
Mulibwanji.
Ndiligwino Kaino.
Right, which means?
Pelive Ndalama.
Pelive Ndalama is no money.
Is that no money?
I shouldn't have had that phrase when I was also in Malawi.
Pelive Ndalama.
We
Which we used to say as kids, because like the street kids would come up to you and they'd be kind of harassing you a bit. You just go, believe in the Lama.
Right.
No money.
Kids are very adaptable though, but obviously you're getting on a plane, you're going somewhere you've never been, you've obviously spent time in Malawi, which compared to Australia, very, very, very different place.
I think it's
so different.
Full credit to our parents.
Yeah.
We just thought it was this huge adventure. And talking to Mum now, because obviously we moved from Brisbane to Sydney, and that's quite stressful. And I was just talking to Mum and how stressful it must have been for her to move. And we did not pick up on it. We thought that this was this wonderful new adventure that we were
just
going on.
The flight. Alone, with four kids. Which I'm doing with two kids in about 3 weeks. It's like, wow, what pills can we give them? I'm only joking about that. But yeah, it must have been a tremendously challenging period.
For them, I'm sure it was, but for us it was quite fun. And then we got here and obviously Australia's just unbelievably so different. When we first got here, you know the garbage truck that comes and picks up the bins?
Yes.
And okay, that's like gross and smelly. Every single Monday we used to go watch it because we'd never seen anything like this.
We used to wake up at 6 a.m. and like sit outside and watch the rubbish bins being emptied into the bin.
Because it was just like, it was mesmerizing. We'd never seen anything like that. And the roads were clean. We were like, people aren't locking up here. In South Africa, where our grandparents lived, and we used to visit them a lot.
Where was in South Africa?
In Joburg.
Okay.
There was one house that didn't have a big fence around it, and we used to call it the house with no fence.
Yeah.
And we used to go drive past it and look at it. And then we came to Australia and, like, literally no house has a wall around it. We couldn't believe it. People were leaving things on the street. It wasn't getting stolen. Everything was clean. We went to South Bank in Brisbane. We're like, what is this facility? How is this happening? It was all just mesmerizing to us. So as kids, we were sort of very starry-eyed when we got here. It was pretty special.
First days of school, you probably remember them more, I would have thought, Kate. That's when it gets tricky for kids, first day.
First day at school ever. Of course. Yeah, you know, I'd never been in a school, so I can remember being incredibly nervous. And, I mean, I already kind of stick out because I'm like very tall, and I was like pale and gangly because I just spent all my time outdoors. So I was like pale and freckly and gangly. And I had this weird South African accent, and all I wanted to do and all any kid wants to do is to fit in. And so the only thing I could change was my accent. So I now speak with an Australian accent much more than a South African accent. But yeah, I remember it being really, really scary. I was very, very awkward socially, as I think all kids are. And but everyone was really lovely. And it takes a while to get used to it. And there were a few tears, as there always are. But I found it like a little group of misfits who I fitted in well with. And yeah, it's been going well so far.
Where does swimming start in this whole story, bro?
Swimming was always there. I mean, in Malawi, it's quite tropical. There's the wet and dry season,
yep.
And it's just hot all year. That's it. So there wasn't really any aircon. Power was intermittent. So swimming was just what we did. We always did it. We were always in the swimming pool. Mum used to teach all the local expat kids swimming lessons. So
she was a synchronized swimmer for South Africa.
Was she? Really?
Yeah,
she was. Yeah,
but it was during apartheid, so South Africa was banned from all international competitions. So she couldn't compete at a Commonwealth or an Olympic Games, but she did qualify for the South African national team, and she still has her full tracksuit and some of her medals, which we used to look at as kids, which is really exciting. So mum used to hold swimming lessons in our backyard swimming pool and actually teach synchronized swimming at the local high school, and we used to join in with that because we had the choice of we either sat on the side of the pool while she taught or we could join in the class.
Mum was pretty harsh though. I mean, I was probably about 6 and Kate was 8, and we're training with the high school kids, and she's like, you either keep up and don't complain or you get out.
Hardcore.
Yeah.
So we learned we had to keep up pretty quickly. But and then just before we moved to Australia, it was 2000 and the Olympics were on. I remember watching them, and we knew we were about to move to Australia, so we were watching out for the Australians. I remember watching like Grant Hackett just swim that 1500. I was just watching with like these, you know, those big kid eyes that they get when they see something that's inspirational. I was like, that's exactly what I want to do. I'm going to swim 1500 for Australia.
That was the spark, was it?
That was it. But very soon after starting swimming, I realized I didn't want to swim 1500 meters.
It's a lot of laps.
so many laps. I don't want to train for that. I don't want to do that. And I would be terrible at it, by the way.
So you were the driving force early days?
Very much. Yeah, so I loved it. And I was obsessed. Once we got here, we joined the local swim club, which was just down the road from the where we were renting. And I used to get up about an hour early and walk myself to the pool and go and watch the big kids train because I thought, this is surely going to make me better. And then I'd train for an hour or so. I was only seven. I wanted to do two sessions a day, but both mum and my coach said, you're not allowed to do that.
That's reasonably good parenting, I would have thought.
They said, there are no seven-year-old Olympic champions, so just calm down. You've got a few more years to go. But I was completely obsessed with it right from when I was young. And when you're young, you don't even think that it's a big thing. You think, oh, yeah, of course I'm going to go to the Olympics for swimming. Because there's a little group of all us kids, and that's all what we used to talk about. Oh, after I go to the Olympics, this is what I'm going to do. Which was quite nice for mum and dad because they never told us that we couldn't do it, which was a big part of it. They never said, that's going to be a really hard thing to do. Maybe you should have a plan B. They were like, okay, great. If you're going to do it, go on. Be free, do it, and see how far it gets you. And
what were you doing, Lazy Bones?
Oh, yeah, I took a little while to get around to the whole Olympic ideal. I suffer from this chronic disease called laziness. It's really bad.
I thought we were getting serious about it then.
Oh, no. I go through spates of like it being really, really chronic, and then I get better at it. When we moved to Australia, I was in a lull, a pretty bad time. So while Bronte used to get up like an hour early and go to training, Mum used to get me out of bed, be like, okay, Kate, you need to go to training now. And I used to roll in and just do the bare minimum. I can remember like swimming to the flags and then just thinking that it was too far to swim, the extra 5 meters into the wall and the 5 meters out. So why didn't I just turn around at the flags? It seemed like a reasonable thing. I used to let people lap me so that I could like do fewer laps. But the problem was that I was training with Bronte, who not only knew how many laps she's done, she knows how many laps you've done as well.
She's a mathematician over there.
I can count.
I'd like hit the wall and be like, oh yeah, I'm just gonna stop now. And I'd put my head up and Bronte would tap me on the head and be like, excuse me, you've got two more laps. So
I come off looking like a really horrible goody t-shirt.
She was. And then we went to our first swimming carnival, and Bronte won every 25 meter. So we were just swimming 25 meters, all her 25 meter races, and got 4 golds and an age champion trophy. I got bronze for the 25 meters backstroke, which I wasn't that unhappy with. Like, I still got something to wear around my neck. However, Bronte used to wear her medals around her neck at home.
I love this.
And they clink together, like, you know, the clinking that you make. So you'd hear her coming down the corridors. And she used to bring, I'm not lying, she used to bring her trophy to the dinner table and like just position like Nadal positions his water bottles. She used to position her trophy like next to her glass of water.
So I just say, like, I was seven and this is the only time in my life I've ever done any of those things.
No, I like it. Continue, Kate, please.
And so I did what any, you know, self-respecting 9-year-old whose younger sister has beaten them and is rubbing it in her face. I stole her medals and her trophy.
Fantastic.
Yeah, of course I did. And I hid them under my bed. It wasn't the most original hiding spot. They were found very quickly. And Mum kind of sat me down and she said, Kate, Bronte's worked really hard for those. And if you want what Bronte has, you're going to have to work hard because I've seen you. You don't train very hard. You're pretty lazy. And you either need to just accept that this is, you know, Bronte's achievement and be happy for her, or you need to start working hard if you want to win some of your own. And I was like, oh, man, really? Okay. The gold medals looked so shiny. So I decided that I wanted to work hard. And Bronte wanted to go to the Olympics, and for lack of imagination, I decided that if you can't beat them, join them. So, yeah, I guess that from then I decided that I looked at, you know, the joy that it brought Bronte and the fact, I think, that I'd seen her work really hard to get them, whereas, you know, I kind of looked at my bronze medal and was like, oh, yeah, pretty happy. But where Bronte looked at these and was so proud of them. necessarily
possibly
proud.
Possibly a little bit too proud of her, let's be honest.
But I think that, you know, looking back, there was something that I wanted to be proud of something as well. So, yeah, from that moment, poor mum had two Olympic hopeful swimmers on her hands, which is a lot for any parent.
We can skip around in this podcast, which is the best thing about it. You will have been asked this question 1,000 times in 1,000 different ways. I want you to answer separately. And
are you going to say something about rivalry?
Well, yeah. It's the question that is so obvious and you've been asked it so many times. I was talking to Elise Perry the other day and she was for the show and she was talking about being asked when she was going to decide which sport. Mm. And she would go into almost a political answer because she had her answer and she didn't really think about it. The delight of you two, as is evidenced in 25 minutes here, is you seem so close. You finish each other's sentences. You're like an old married couple. You look at each other to see when one is going to finish talking, the other one picks up. What is it actually like competing against your sister, who is typically, for you two, the one person you have to beat to win that gold medal that you're talking about, Kate? Start with you, Bronte. Be as honest as you can.
Yeah, it's I understand why people think it's a weird dynamic, but seeing as we started from where we were as kids, that's what gives a bit more understanding to it, because we used to sit in the back of the car together and talk about, on the way to swimming, like what we were going to do at the Olympics, what we were going to do after we'd been to the Olympics. And it was a very much a shared dream. We're like, oh, we could be like two sisters in the Olympics. It was a really big deal for us.
At that time, we were doing different events as well.
We were doing different events. So, Kate was a breaststroker, I was a backstroker when we were kids, and then we sort of ended up in freestyle through various circumstances. Mine was I got rubbish at backstroke.
Right. So
everyone else got better and I didn't anymore. But, yeah, then it was always a shared dream from the beginning. So that sort of brings a little bit of light onto it. But if you think about it, when you're in the moment and you're in, say, an Olympic final, if there's anybody in that race who you want to do well, who's not you, you want it to be a sister. Of course you do. So it's not even about competing against each other. And there's so many different ways of doing well. I know everyone wants a gold medal and everyone who's standing up in that race is trying to win. But we're lucky in swimming you've got an objective measure as well, as you've got a time and you've got how your race has panned out. You've got so many ways to measure success. So it's about trying to win, but it's not always about beating each other. And there's no way I'm ever standing up behind the blocks thinking, oh, I want to beat Kate. I'm not thinking I want to beat anyone. I'm thinking purely about myself. As soon as you start thinking about beating other people, I think you've already lost the race, or lost the point of it at the very least. So it's always been beautiful for us. It's always been so nice for us to have the other person there and share that moment. Not many people get to share that with anyone that they're close to, and I get to share it with my sister. So really, it's like, I can see how it seems like it would be a hard thing, but it's the easiest thing.
Oh, it does seem like a hard thing. And the first two Australians to compete in an Olympic final together in the same event, a couple of examples off the top of my head. One of the World Championships in Kazan, 2015. You're the world record holder, you get beat by your sister. Commonwealth Games, again in the 100, you get beat by your sister. You turn around, you look up there, and you've come second. And you've done everything you can to come first. There's no part of you, Kate, that thinks, ah, bugger.
Of course there is.
Right.
Everyone wants to win.
Yeah.
That's human nature. And we're very, very competitive people. You don't get into sport if you're not competitive. But like Bronte said, if there was one other person who you'd want to beat you, it's your sister. Like, and you can't win everything. You know, no one wins everything. Even Usain Bolt didn't win every race he ran in. And I know that I wouldn't be the swimmer that I am today if I didn't have Bronte there to push me and to push me every day in training. I think that we bring out the best in each other in and out of the pool. And I think it's been a real credit to our parents in that they never made us compete against each other. It was never about competing against each other in anything in life. It's the same with, you know, the five kids in the family. So we're two of five children, which I think can be hard if you're, you know, one of the other three and you have two Olympic sisters. It was about achieving your best, and what's that for you? And for me and Bronte, it's going to an Olympic Games. For our younger sister, it's about achieving an A in English. And all of those things are achieved and recognized, but we were never played off against each other. There was never this competitive dynamic where you sat down at the dinner table and you played who's the favorite child or who's achieved the most. And I think that's really helped. We go out there and we compete and we want to get the best out of ourselves. And of course you want to win. I'm not about to sit here and say that you don't want to win.
No one who's in sport gets into a race and says, oh, wouldn't it be great if I came fourth?
But I think that the point is that so many sisters, brothers and sisters out there, they obviously grow up, everyone has different relationships.
Mm.
They would want nothing more than to beat their sister or their brother, whereas you two never seem to have that.
And I think
it's
because we've never competed against each other.
Yeah, we never have. I mean,
except for maybe Mario Kart.
Yeah, something like that.
Mario Kart, who comes out on top there?
I am better at that.
It's true. Right.
So this is the only time we see Dubby Speech in the Mario Kart.
Yeah, down that remote.
I can live with that.
Storm out of the room.
Campbell sisters aren't perfect. I'm happy with that.
No, but I do see how it is a weird dynamic. I see that, but having grown up with it, it sort of evolved quite naturally into being something that's quite normal for us. And of course, as you said before, you look up, you've come second, you wanted to win.
Mm.
There is that moment where you're like, oh, man. But you'd much rather it was Kate that beat you than someone from America or Sweden, just as you'd much rather it was your countryman that was doing well than someone else. And the closer you get together, the less it hurts to be beaten by someone. Not the more it hurts. If it's someone completely distanced from you, it's quite easy to hate them, and I'm quite good at that. But when it's someone that's close to you, it's sort of bittersweet. You're disappointed, but you've also got this elation for them as well. It's good to see people that you love doing well. That's a pretty simple thing that everyone understands.
Yeah,
so
absolutely. That's
what,
way
basically what it boils down to.
So the Olympics, this dream that was furnished in Carter Bay in Malawi. Kate, you've been to three?
Yes.
Beijing, London, and Rio. You've been to Rio
and London.
And London, so you've been to the last two. So you're the first to experience it. Before we get into your Olympic experiences, which have been full of highs and lows, like most athletes, describe to me, I'll start with you, Bron, as it was your dream, in 50 words or less, what it's like to be competing at the Olympics.
I think I could describe it in about two words, which is exceeds expectations.
Wow. And you, Kate?
My first memory of an Olympic Games was just, it was bigger than I imagined.
Right.
I remember I'd just turned 16 at the first Olympic Games, but it was bigger than I imagined. Yeah. Everything about it.
My memories of you at that time was you were thinner than thin.
She was a beanpole.
Yeah, you were. You were thinner than thin, and you're obviously in a race against big, strong women, the 50
I'm
and the 100 freestyle.
So,
yeah.
Yeah.
And you just had a completely different physique to everyone you were swimming against. If you lined you all up and said, you'd look at the tall, skinny girl and think, well, she's going to snap in half, Bruce Reed style on the 12th man. I'm not sure if you can understand that, but it was physically, she's not going to be able to compete with these girls.
Yeah. Oh, and I was a little 16-year-old. You know, I hadn't matured early. I remember being pimply and gangly.
Puberty
hadn't come for me. Look, it was not kind to me while I was in the midst of it. But I think that, you know, this goes back to our coach, who's the reason that we've moved to Sydney. So
your
he's been our
name.
Coach, Simon Cusack, we've been with him for 17 years. So he was that first coach, that first swimming pool that we walked into when we moved to Australia. So he's known us since we're 7 and 9 years old. he's a pretty revolutionary guy. And he was always on to us about technique. And I think that you can muscle over the water or you can work with it. And I think he taught us to work with it. And so it kind of helped tall, gangly me. I'm really muscly and I've filled out, come through the other side of puberty. But yeah, I think that it was all those years of drills that I just thought were fun, but that really made a difference. And technically, we're both very good swimmers because of it.
Yeah.
How's he revolutionary?
He looked at swimming and he looked at if you wanted to swim 50 and 100 meters, why are you swimming 6 or 7 Ks a session? And why are you practicing training at a pace that is so unspecific to your race? So why do I want to be able to swim 100s in 110 when I'm racing, I want to be swimming them in 52 seconds. So how do we train that specifically? How do we work on those? And I think that he just got really bored when he used to give everyone long sets, which is more to the point. And so it's like, okay, how can we mix this up? And how can we make sure that when you go and you stand behind the block, that you're fit at your race pace, you're not fit at this unspecific. And of course you need an aerobic base and we do that, but we do a lot more race specific training.
Well, especially for the time when he first started doing it, people thought he was absolutely crazy. But we used to stand up on, we knew it was coming on Monday afternoon and we had 10:50s max on the 130, which doesn't sound that hard. But if we were not within 0.5 of our PB in the first one, so basically as fast as you can swim on race day, 0.5 is nothing. Then you went in the far lane and you did 2100s on the 130, which is so boring. So everyone wanted to be fast and everyone knew they had to step up and perform, which means you're at your race stroke rate, you're at your race pace, and you know exactly what that feels like. So as soon as you dive in for 100 meters or 50 meters, you've done that a million times. Like, why would we be training at the 2100s pace for the majority of our training time? So that's sort of what he started with us when we were kids as well.
It also taught us to stand up and race under any circumstance, like, because you did not want to be doing those 2100s. Yeah. So lots of people, you know, we're typically quite good in season races. Like even at the smaller competitions, we can stand up and post really good times. And people say, how do you do that? And it's simply because right from when we were really young, we were taught that we have to race no matter what. One of his favorite sayings was, oh, it doesn't matter how you feel, it only matters what you do. Seriously, I've heard that so many times.
If only the people who were listening could see you two rolling your eyes as you said that.
But actually, he's not wrong.
it's very true. And it's something that I'm grateful for in retrospect.
All right, we're talking training. Now it's your turn to face the hard questions from my 9-year-old daughter.
Yes.
You get the pickle.
You're the pickle.
Far more excited by her questions than mine. All right, here's for you, Bron.
Hi, Bronte. Pickle here. I want to be a triathlete when I get older. But when we do training in Victoria, the water's really cold. It's so hardcore. What's the most hardcore thing you do in training?
Ooh. I did not know where that question was going from the start.
Hardcore. Hardcore is jumping in the local river / ocean in late August when there's a southerly blowing and it's about 13 degrees out and about 12 in the water.
No. Yeah, okay. Well, that is hardcore because the coldest I've ever been was in Melbourne when we had to swim in an unheated pool and it scarred me for life. So that is pretty hardcore. What's the most hardcore thing we do in training?
Just the sheer volume of training to me when I see you guys is what blows my mind.
I mean that, but most people do that. So that's, I mean, not most people, most swimmers do that. Most people do a lot. Most swimmers are doing a lot and quite frankly doing more Ks than we do. The most hardcore thing we do, which is, it's going to sound so pathetic to people, but
no.
We have this set, which is 450s. It's now only 450s max on the 2 minutes. And that doesn't sound like you should be hurting at the end of it, but we measure lactate. So lactate is how many millimoles of lactate acid they are per, what, liter of, or 100 milliliters of blood. You measure it just by an ear prick. So that's like that burning sensation. That's your lactate acid, like clearing from your muscles into your blood. And if you can get like a 16 lactate, that's pretty high. Once you get to 24, the machine doesn't register anymore. And after doing that set, we break the machine.
Break the machine?
Well, you don't break it, but it can't read it anymore. It just says HI, which I don't know what that means.
High.
Too high.
too high for the machine.
Too high.
Wow.
So we don't do that often, but that is the most amount of pain we ever get to in training. That's you are 100% going to go vomit in the bathroom. I'm a bit of a vomiter myself. I quite often retch in the gutters and stuff. Okay, it doesn't really get that.
In the pool?
Yeah, well, wow. I get to the side and yep. spew on the side because it's a bit gross in the pool. But, okay, it doesn't really get that as much, but it's, like, I get it all in my stomach straight afterwards as it's clearing. But that is the most gut-wrenching set in every case. You get up the next morning, you're like, everything's heavy and sore, and that is the most amount of pain I think I'm ever going to be in the pool. No race is ever going to come close to that, and that's why we do it.
Back to Kate and Bronte, the legends, in a moment. Next up on the Howie Games, Thursday, July 18. Can't tell you who the guest is, but trust me, it is going to be a cracker, so keep an eye out for it. Remember, subscribe, you can't miss it. All right, back to the sisters.
So along those lines, because I'm fascinated by the amount of work that you guys put in, I was lucky enough to deal with a lot of athletes. Tell me briefly, don't go through every session, but tell me briefly, in your words, Kate, in hard training, a typical day, when does it start? What are you eating? When do you finish training? And I presume you just go home and collapse.
Yeah, so we structure our weeks in cycles. So in a week, we'll do 9 swim sessions, 3 gym, 2 spin bike and 2 Pilates. So we have like 2 swim Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and then a big combined gym, swim, spin, Pilates on Tuesday, Thursday and Saturday.
So what time's the swim session
so,
start?
So in Pimble, we'll be starting at 6:30 in the okay. morning, so not that bad. We did do 12 years of 5 a.m. in the water.
So what time's the alarm go off for that?
As late as possible. We've always lived quite close to our swimming pool, so, okay. you know, 4:15, 4:30 to get up, get to the pool, do a few stretches and then dive in.
Wow.
So, yeah, we did that all through school, which it's maybe why I was not so great at maths.
You'd be sleeping.
We did 5:07 in the morning and 5:07 at night, which is, I mean, you're leaving home at 4:30 and then you're getting home at 7:30 at night. That's a long day.
It is.
I honestly don't think I could do that now. Yeah. You need childhood energy for that sort of stuff.
And what about calories and then, intake?
Yeah, so I just need to eat frequently. Like, we're kind of coming up to 3 hours since I last ate, so I'm starting to get a little bit hangry.
Those fantails aren't the way forward. Yeah, I'm happy to take you on in that competition as many times you want, Jimmy Barnes.
So,
We should put a video on Kate. She got such a fright.
She did.
So, Kate gets frightened really easily. I'm going to put together a little compilation sometime for right. them, but... it doesn't have to be anything. It could just be, hey, Kate. And she goes to fright. I've never seen anyone startle reflex
yeah, when,
like
when
that.
We used to live together and it was just the two of us, I'd be cooking in the kitchen and Bronte would be like, hey, Kate. Oh,
so apart,
I didn't realise you were there.
Apart from the Fantails, are you mega healthy eaters?
I'm so strict in every most other areas of my life that if I had to weigh my food or count my calories, it would just suck the joy out of life. So I always eat before training. I usually have like a bowl of cereal and then come back and have eggs and something, an avocado and toast, something really substantial. And it's pretty much just eating when you're hungry.
And eating good things. I mean, like most of the time we're making our own food and stuff. I mean, the more you eat out, the more you're not really in control of what you're eating, which is fine as well, because I want to be able to go out with my mates and have a burger at Betty's Burgers or whatever they have here. So it's more about eating enough food and frequently, and most of it being good.
Yeah, most of it that you've it's really I wish I could give you like some secrets, but I'm also the laziest cook. Like, if it has more than 8 ingredients, I don't want to cook it because I don't want to go buying all the ingredients and I don't want to chop them all up.
Mm.
If I, seriously, least amount of effort possible and I'm fine.
And lots of protein, obviously good for us and muscle building, and then carbs are great when we're training, but not so much when you're having time off. So
What's the biggest in getting up and training and doing all these things each individually? I don't know if you would look at it as a sacrifice, but... from where I'm looking, you're sacrificing things to do what you want to do and live your dreams. What's the biggest sacrifice for you, Bron? Is it a food or a time or friends or sleep or
I don't sacrifice sleep. I make sure I prioritize sleep. As in an ideal day when you're training the 2 sessions, you go home and you sleep. And that's not because you can't get through the day without it. That's because if you don't do that, you're not going to be at your best that afternoon. So I prioritize sleep over everything else. But yeah, it is. It's quite an isolating thing. You're doing something that's different to what anyone else is doing. Everyone's working in the middle of the day. You've got the middle of the day free, and then you're exhausted by the end of it. So it's very different to what everyone else does. And particularly when you're younger, now as you're older, it's people are, I don't know, a bit more flexible. But especially when you're younger, everyone else doesn't know what they want to do. No one's got a lot of drive. And, well, not no one, but most of your school friends, and they don't really know what they want to do. They want to go to uni. Mm. They want to go to parties. And it's a very isolating thing from that, because you're not having any part of that. So particularly when you're younger, it's a very... Now as we're older, I think people appreciate it a bit more, and they're a lot more inclusive and understanding of where you can spend your time, which isn't often with them.
Yeah, I would agree. It's socially, it's just little things in that we don't get public holidays. We train every
weekend. Today is a public holiday.
Today is a public holiday. And yeah, we never get public holidays.
Me neither. I didn't know it was until I texted you saying, yeah. Hey, I just realised
tomorrow's
a public holiday.
We're like, we're fine.
Yeah.
You're talking to athletes or people who work in media. They don't get public holidays. But I think that was probably the biggest sacrifice, especially like Bronte said, when we were younger. And I was very, very driven as a young kid, and I and people would say, oh, you know, just come out just this once. I'd be like, no, I have to go to training and I have to do these things. And so after a while, people just stop inviting you. And even if you can't go, it's still nice to be invited. But I think that as the years have gone on, as people's lives get busier as well, you know, where they're not just going out or going to uni when they have jobs and other hobbies and things, that they are more understanding. But yeah, it's
a we're saying a sacrifice, but we're just saying it's 100% a choice. I mean, I think who said that to me first? I think who said that? I can't even remember. Who's the high jumper? Stark. What's his first name?
Brandon.
That's his name. Sorry, Brandon. we had a good chat. But I think he was the first person that said it like that to me. I was like, that's a good way to look at it. Because it is a choice, and we choose it, and we choose it a million times over. The experiences that we've got to have are pretty incredible, and we chose to have them, and we chose to let the other ones lie, which is, I mean, your life is just full of choices. That's all your life is. It's just which choices you make, and I don't regret any of mine, so...
All right, so we get to the Olympics, and I've actually had to write some stuff down because normally my memory is pretty good, but when you're dealing with two freaks with world records and there's all sorts going on here. Kate, first Olympics for you, 2008 Beijing, bronze in the 50 metre. I think probably Lib Triggett would have been the superstar then, would she?
Yeah, she actually came fourth. So Britta Steffen, Germany, won.
Yep.
And then Dara Torres, who was 42, got second. And then me at 16 got third. So... yeah, it was a pretty interesting medal podium.
Dara Torres, she was at 38th Olympics, wasn't she?
I think it was her fourth Olympics. And she had a baby, came out of retirement, and at 42 managed a silver, which is very, very impressive.
I don't want to gloss over it, but we won't have time to go through it all. So we get to 2012.
Mm-hmm.
You've both qualified for the Olympics.
Yes.
Because that was back when Channel 10 had the rights, so I remember you guys jumping out of the pool, and it's like, wow, you're the first sisters. You'll be competing in the same event. What was it like being at the Olympics for you for the first time, Bron, in London? Because you'd been the one driving this dream.
Yeah, well, at the beginning, it was probably a lot easier for me than most people's first Olympics are. I had Kate's experiences from 2008 to draw on, which I'd obviously heard about, but I was also rooming with Kate and competing with her, and there was pretty much no aspect of where I was going to be going that Kate wasn't there and explaining how everything works, which is pretty daunting when you first step onto the national team. So for me, it was probably, it was a lot easier than most people's first Olympics, and it was incredible. I loved every second of it. It was a pretty challenging Olympics because the first night was incredible. The the girls got up in their 4x100 freestyle and they were, what, a second and a half, 2 seconds behind on paper. The Dutch team were the world record holders and they were 100% going to win and Australia was going to compete for a place. And then every single girl got up and just did the swim of their lives. Everyone did their job as well as they could have, and the Dutch team fell apart and they ended up with the first gold medal of the meet on night one. And we're in the stands, everyone's losing it, everyone's so excited.
Kate was swimming,
second swimmer there, and she took them from I think thirds, like within 0.02 of being first, and then Britt and Mel finished it off, which was incredible. So watching that on the first night to me was just like, you know, the stars in your eyes again. It's just incredible. And then I didn't compete until the very last day. So I had another 6 days of trying to like keep the emotions a bit under control. I actually got banned from going to the pool. Well, not banned, but my coach told me I wasn't allowed to go anymore because I was getting like way too into the cheering and so excited for every race. He's like, you've got 7 days until your race. You need to calm down. You're using up all your energy. But that's obviously a tough week because 2 days later, Kate woke up with excruciating pain and vomiting with, what was it again?
Pancreatitis.
So this is before the 100?
So yeah, this is a couple of days after the relay. And I remember not feeling great going to bed and then waking up, must be 5 o'clock in the morning, with just like excruciating pains radiating through like my stomach and back. And I kind of stumbled out to the bathroom and vomited. And then I think I passed out. And Bronte kind of came out and like heard the thud as I hit the floor and saw me lying on the ground, and I was like pale and sweating, and she had to run for the medic.
Wow.
At 5 o'clock in the morning.
And it being pancreatitis, which is such a bizarre thing to get. So that was obviously then this weird disruption in the middle of the week. Kate couldn't do her 100 freestyle. Somehow they got her behind the blocks with 50, which really shouldn't have happened. She shouldn't really have been racing.
The blood tests didn't come back until after I'd finished. They just thought it was kind of a stomach bug. So pancreatitis, your pancreas produces enzymes to help digest your food. I think in layman's terms, if you get pancreatitis, it produces too many. It like digests itself a bit.
Ew.
It normally affects... yeah, kind of gross. Normally affects middle-aged, overweight, male alcoholics.
Even more ill.
I was clearly in the high-risk category for that. and so they kind of wrote it off as a stomach flu, but took blood tests. And then the day after I competed in the 50, they were like, oh, you actually had pancreatitis. Probably shouldn't have done that.
So after... what's ostensibly 4 years preparation, but it's really at this stage probably 12 years preparation, when you realise you can't compete in your favourite event, how does one deal with that?
To be honest, I was that sick that I didn't really care.
Yeah, okay.
And I think that I had to accept this turn of events. It all kind of played out and was so far beyond my control that I almost couldn't be upset about it. I was upset, but... there was nothing I could do. You know, I was doing everything right. And it's actually, you know, I got up behind the blocks and I raced the heats and the semi-finals of the 50 freestyle and didn't make the finals. But it's actually one of the times in my swimming career that I'm really proud of how I handled it, because everything that I could control and everything that I could do right, I did do right. And I fell apart afterwards. But the whole time I was like, okay, Gatorade now, you can eat, you know, some plain white rice, try and get some sustenance in you. And it was all moving forwards to the goal of competing. And after it was over, then I realized how awful it was and had a big cry. But while I was going through it, it was all about, you know, the goal and the next step. And I didn't have time to feel sorry for myself.
So the crazy thing about your sport, as we said right at the start, was the ISL?
ISL,
ISL, yep. Is that typically we only see you guys, unfortunately, once every 4 years. And the thing that's always blown me away once I started working on swimming is the difference between success and failure, both for the athlete and the way the country views it, is remarkable. And I always go back to London and James Magnussen, who was always fantastic to me, dealing with him on the pool deck. And he got beaten in the 100 by, was it Nathan Adrian? By 1/100th of a second. He won a silver medal in an Olympics where I don't think we won an individual gold medal. And he was seen as a failure. And I remember thinking, wow, this bloke's come second by 1/100th of a second and he's viewed as a failure. So we move on. The reason I say that, we move on to 2016 now, which you two had the highest of highs and the lowest of lows in the space of a week. In Rio, let's start with the high. Let's start with the positive. Because I was watching it last night, the 4x100 relay, you get to swim together in an Olympic final. You were third, Bronte, off.
I was.
I even wrote it down here. You were behind someone, Vollmer.
Dana Vollmer.
Dana.
Dana Vollmer is in the water, as is Bronte Campbell for Australia.
I'm thinking things are looking a bit shaky here. I knew the result and I was still on YouTube going, wow, Bronte's got a bit of work to do here.
Yeah,
so it's an Olympic final. You're swimming with your sister that you grew up with, that you spent all this time with, and you're there, like you're smiling about it now, the chance to win an Olympic gold medal together, I would imagine life could get no sweeter.
Yeah, it's huge. That's what we love about it. The relays, it's always what we look forward to the most. Not only was I racing with Kate for once and not against her, I was also racing with two of the girls who I'd grown up with, so Britt Elmsley and Emma McKeon, who are also in that relay. They're the same age as me, so we were in the same age group all the way up. So everyone there, they're like your little swimming family, and now you're going to step up together and try and achieve something great. We were the clear favourites going in, having won the year before and being the world record holders. But it takes something special to win an Olympics. It's not about rankings going in. So it was an incredible feeling when I turned. I remember the race pretty well, which you don't normally do. But
talk me through.
I remember I could see, I think I was going off Brit, and I could see that we were behind. I drove in. I was probably like just at Dana's shoulders or hips. And we were going out in the first 50, and always the temptation is to try catch them as quickly as possible. You want to be in front. Everyone wants to be in front. But I just sort of sat there and took it easy. Like, we talk about easy speed on the way out. And I could see her kicking, and she was just going for it. And then as soon as we turned, I, like, turned on the burners and off I went, because I knew when I saw her kicking that much on the way out, I was like, she is going to hurt, and I'm going to catch her. And I just got to, like, take my time and do it.
It's been a brilliant performance by Bronte Campbell. She's done just that. Kate stands, waits, and in the water now.
And then when I handed over to Kate and we're in front, I was thinking, even though Katie Ledecky was anchoring for the US, I was thinking there's no way anyone's going to catch Kate if I can give her a lead. And when I put my hand on the wall, I turned around and we're in front. You never count your chickens, but I knew it was going to be a good race at the very least. And Kate brought it home like you couldn't believe. Fantastic split time and world record, and there we all are, so stoked. It's an incredible feeling. It's such a good feeling. It doesn't get much better than that.
So, Bront touches, you dive in. Now you can take up the story.
Yeah, and I kind of knew, having trained with Bronte all the time, when she puts on those afterburners, there are very, very few people who can catch her, and I could just see her, you know, steaming away. And I had this beautiful clear water to enter into, which is every swimmer's dream. You don't want to be entering in the washing machine. And it's one of those races that I don't remember a whole lot. I remember kind of turning and seeing that I was still in front and just thinking, you just have to keep going. You don't want to be that person who gets caught. And yeah, hitting the wall with a world record time.
How's this for history? The sisters are going to win gold together. The Olympic champions, world record holders. They defend their title and they break the world record.
And then like reaching up and celebrating with the girls. And we kind of stood at the, but behind the podium, and we just kind of said, girls, remember this, you know, take a moment and all this craziness. And there's so much craziness. There's, you know, cameras flashing and people cheering and so many colors and sights and sounds. But we said, you know, remember this moment, because you won't have it again. And it's really, really special. And Britt Elmsley and I had won in 2012, and we said that I don't remember much of that. I just remember probably walking around with my hands on my face an awful lot and my mouth wide open. And that's about my memory of that. But we decided to slow things down. And as we raised each other's hands to take that top spot on the podium and, you know, belted out Advance Australia Fair with, you know, that line, Girt by Sea, which is just the most hilarious line in any national anthem, but like we sang it with so much pride.
With your beautiful singing voices.
With our beautiful singing, swimming voices.
I think that's when we started just going for it with the national anthem. But behind there, we're like, all right, we're only really going to get... There's not many opportunities to sing your national anthem at Olympic Games. We're just going to have to go for it. And the Americans, who are pretty loud, were looking at us like... you can't see my face on the podcast. They were looking at us with this full side eye, being like, what is wrong with these people? But we're just so happy.
So is there any... Because of the strange way in which your sport works... You win your Olympic gold medal, you're in the warm down pool, I've seen it, and then you're back off to the hotel. Is there any chance to celebrate? Because it's obviously, it's the start of the whole thing. It's the start of what you've been trying to achieve for 4 years. Do you get any celebration time? Or is it just the podium and that's it, next thing?
As soon as the podium's done, almost as soon as the race is done, but we extended it to the podium this time, you're thinking about the next race. Because that's day one of an 8-day meet and you've only achieved... a fraction of what your week could hold. So it gets turned off pretty quickly and then you're on to the next thing. At the end of the week, you can sit back and relax.
Yeah, you kind of, as you take that medal off, when you go back under the tunnel after doing the victory lap and waving to all your friends and family, as that medal comes off, you're like, okay, back to business. What do I need to do? Go warm down. And then you need to jump in an ice bath. Then you need to get a massage. So you need to go back to the village and get something to eat. And then you need to get to bed as soon as possible.
How on earth do you get to sleep?
That is the question.
Is it?
Sleeping is hard, and that Olympics was ridiculous anyway because we were starting finals at whatever, what time?
After the American
10:30.
Before the American TV. Yeah, so we didn't get back to the village until 3:30 in the morning that morning. Wow. Which is, and then you're trying to sleep in Rio in the middle of the day with, you know, no windows and no aircon, which was fun. But anyway, that's just how it rolled in Rio, which was fine. It was a whole different thing there. But yeah, you just have to be disciplined. It's so easy to like get caught up in the memories and get excited and dream back. But it's all about discipline. It's you've only done a tiny bit of your job. Just it's like you have to wipe it out like it didn't happen and take a step forward again.
Before we get to, and I mentioned James Magnussen because as I said, it's talked about as failure. Before we get to the difficulties of dealing with failure as an athlete, Kathy Freeman spoke on this podcast about dealing with pressure. She was the pin-up girl for her home Olympics. You two, probably more shouldered by you, Kate, going in as the world record holder into the Olympics in the 100. How did you cope with, or did you have to cope with being the favourite, being the face, being the one everyone expected to win?
Well, I obviously didn't do very well with coping with it. And it's really difficult. And it's more difficult, I think, than people realise. It's something that
You're obviously even a bit emotional talking about it now.
Yeah, I am. I think that it's... I wish I could explain succinctly. I'm probably someone who likes to please people, and I figured out very early on in my life that if I did well in the swimming pool, people were pleased with me. Hmm. And it was programmed into me from when I was a very young kid. You know, I went to my first Olympics at 16, and sport is very fickle because you are loved until your next race. And then if you don't perform well at that next race, you're forgotten about very quickly. And so for me, it wasn't about going out and doing my best or swimming a good 100-meter race. The only way I could see success and the only way I would be to win an Olympic gold medal, which is an incredibly hard thing to do, and it's an incredibly rare thing. And I looked at all these people who I could make happy with this achievement, or who I thought only saw value in me if I achieved that goal. And I was scared of letting them down. I was not excited to go out and race. I wasn't excited to go out and challenge myself. I was afraid. And that's not a position that you want to be in. It's quite lonely and isolating. And I think that it's been a very liberating experience coming out the other side. My memories of the race, so to give people context, I went in as like the red hot favorite. I'd broken the world record a couple of months earlier. I was 0.7 ahead on paper. Blitzed through the heats, blitzed through the semifinals, was, you know, in lane four. And then, and I was fine because there's no consequences of those. I knew that I could do the rounds, but it was suddenly when everything counted, when I had this chance to fulfill everyone's dreams and everyone's goals and my own goals as well, that suddenly I was like, can I do this? I'm not sure I can. I'm not sure I'm strong enough to hold the weight of all of this.
When did you have these thoughts?
It was after the semi-final. And I had only intermittently been in contact with people, and I received a message from someone who was quite a close friend, and it said, oh, I've booked out my boardroom so that my whole office can watch you. And I was just like, oh, shit. Like, what happens if I don't win? This guy has booked out his boardroom and he's got all his friends to come and watch me. And if I don't do it, he's going to look like a fool. Wow. And from there, it just kind of spiraled out of control.
Eight has the fastest time in the world. Bronte, the second fastest.
And it's funny. It's been a very liberating experience because I knew... I wish I could take the first 11 seconds of that race back because I went out too hard. That first 25, I was too stiff and I used up just too much glycogen, too much of my sprint energy, which doesn't give you the payoff in the back end. And if I could just have those first 11 seconds back, I would be fine.
Kate Campbell, C1 in lane four. Bronte in lane two. In between them is Menrol of the USA. She's the threat at the moment.
But I knew when I put my feet on the wall for the 50 metres to go that it was going to be a really long way back.
You were comfortably in front at that point, though.
Yeah, but you know.
Yeah. Kate was in front. It wasn't a comfortable in front. There's, as we were talking before, it's easy speed on the way out. And you want to be going fast, but you don't want to be trying. And as soon as you know you're trying on the way out... You don't know you've lost the race, but you know that it's going to be a fight to get back.
And how's your race going at this point, Bron?
So I was out in lane two.
Because I think you were the fastest two times going in, I think, weren't you?
Probably. I mean, my time was from World Champs yep. the year before.
Okay.
And maybe one other person had gone faster than that, but I'm not sure. I was one of the fastest officially from a year before going in. But... pretty much soon after Kazan, which is when I did that time, I got hip injury in the November, and then that January I got shoulder injury, which saw me do like 3K a session, which is just, it's not enough. I couldn't train for like 8 months.
Yeah, it was tough because I think that actually Bronte succeeded. She executed the best race she possibly could have and got fourth in that Olympic Games. And for her, that was like a gold medal to stand up. And you didn't hear that Bronte was injured. You didn't hear anything because she kept it to herself. And it was, there's nothing more frustrating than wanting to achieve something and working for it and not being able to, and for your body to have failed you. It's this soul crushing, and then you're living with pain all the time. You're in constant pain. And you know that when you get in the swimming pool, it's going to make it worse, but you have to because you've got your lifelong dream coming up. But you know that by the time the 2 hours is up, if you make it through the 2 hours, you're going to be in 8 out of 10 pain and you're going to have to go and lie down in bed and put ice packs on and... take more anti-inflammatories than is good for the human body. And then you're going to have to get up the next morning and you're going to have to do that again.
So how was that for you, Bronte, going through that?
At the time, it was enormously frustrating. All you want to do is, like, not be sad. It was a weird race because I knew I wasn't going to be at my best. I can train pretty hard. That's That's what I've been good at for my whole swimming career. So when I stand up behind the blocks and you can look back at the work and then you just back yourself 100%. That's how I love to race. And I love racing. So I love standing up behind the blocks and you just go, all right, like, bring it on. Let's see what we can do here. Let's see what everyone's got. Let's all give it to each other. And then at the end, there's someone who's come first and there's someone who's come eighth. And that's how it works. But standing up behind the blocks, it was a different feeling trying to back yourself when you know that you haven't done the work and you know that you couldn't have done the work. And it's so, such a frustrating place to be. But the relay was incredible for me because it was a faster time than I thought I could have gone. For me, it was even just to make the Olympic team was a big deal because I got that injury 2 months before the trials. And then to be on the team was incredible. And to be up behind the blocks was incredible. But at the same time, you are aware that everyone has this expectation that you're going to be swimming 52.5. And you know you haven't done the work for it. You just know you're not at that level. But you have to make yourself step up to the level that you can be to compete. So it was horrible.
So what those tears in your eyes as you're describing that, does that come from looking back at the pain or that you couldn't do what you wanted to do or that you... But where does that emotion come from?
That's interesting. It's probably looking back at it because then in the time you're frustrated and there's definitely some meltdowns along the way. But it just comes from, I guess it's just the whole emotion of it because it's a big thing. This is everything you've ever dreamt of, and then to be throttled in the last little bit. And there's no regret there, but there's a lot of, yeah, you're in a lot of pain all the time. There's a lot of what if, like, oh, what if that shoulder injury hadn't happened? Or what if we'd figured out a way to deal with it better? Or what if that had happened a year later? Or what if 2015 had been 2016? But that's what's so good about sport is that it's so full of what ifs, and there's good ones as well as bad ones. So it's not all bad. I think the emotion comes into it because it's not over for me. I'm still doing the injury thing, so.
Bronte does more rehab exercises than is possible. For her to make it through to Commonwealth Games was a mammoth achievement, and then to stand up and swim the time that she did, that 52.2, and to win the gold medal was, I look at the race and her reaction afterwards, and it's sheer joy. Like there's just joy and elation and that smile, it melts your heart. And for me, watching Bronte struggle with it day in and day out, and she never complains. Like you never hear her complain. And she does an extra half an hour of physio exercises more on top of anyone else before every session we do. So that adds up to, you know, another 4 or 5 hours of exercises a week just to maintain an acceptable level of pain in her body. This isn't to get herself pain-free. This is just to manage the pain and the injuries that she has. And it's an ongoing thing. And I think it's a constant battle because you're in this pain, but you're striving to do something that you love, and the two are at war with each other. And, you know, I've had my fair share of injuries in the past. Very well,
because it's not like Kate's injury-free. I mean, hip surgery, shoulder surgery, neck issues. It's she's been through the lot as well. It's just that mine's a little bit more lingering.
Why?
Kate's already done it.
I need to change the battery in a sec, which is a chance for you to have another Fanta in a sec. But why keep doing that to your body? Like, why not just give it away and say, I've got an Olympic gold medal, I've achieved beyond what any normal human would ever think is possible?
I'm not done yet.
But why not? Like, why would you continue to put yourself through that?
That is a very good question. About November of, not last year now, but November of 2017, just before Com Games was coming up, I was very much asking myself that. Why am I doing this? I'm like breaking my back just to stand still. Like I'm not getting better. I'm getting progressively worse and I'm working so much harder. But then I don't know, there was this, Kate was there for that session, this like meltdown session, where I was just doing my exercises like, this is ridiculous, I cannot believe I'm doing this, and I know I'm going to get in the pool in a little while, and I'm going to be sore and slow, like why am I here? I'm not going to be, I've always wanted to train and get better, and I've always wanted to be like, there's always things I can improve on, and I'm basically chasing perfection, and that's one of the things that really motivates me, is chasing that perfection, trying to be the best you possibly can be. But here I was working so hard and just being so bad at what I was doing. So why would you keep doing it is a good question, and I think...
What's the good answer?
It's still just the dream of it, and it's still... You've got this huge self-doubt, will my body be able to do this anymore? And then... you've got a belief that there's always a way. There's always a way. There's a different way of doing things, but there's always got to be a way. And you've always got to be a little bit more creative. I think maybe it's just pure stubbornness, but that just seems like the worst way to get out of the sport ever is to be defeated by your own body. Like, that's not okay. There's got to be a way to make this work. There always is. There's a solution somewhere. You just got to find out what it is. And once I switched to that mindset and actually ended up finding some exercises that worked pretty well, and then got a big block of training done, and I couldn't believe it when that all came together at Comm Games. I still don't really know how that race ended up how it was, because that race was 2 years of struggling to find that race. So it was like such a big deal for me.
Stand by. I'm going to change our batteries. Hang on.
I'm going to have a fantail.
That's the end of Kate and Bronte Campbell Part A, but don't worry, there's a lot more to come in Part B. Enjoy it.
Listener.